Russia says two American captives will face justice for committing crimes while fighting for the Ukrainian military. Iran accuses Israel of trying to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region by making anti-Tehran allegations. And Tunisia's president receives the draft of the new constitution that increases his powers less than a month before a referendum on the document. Thanks for joining us. The Kremlin says two Americans who were caught fighting Russian forces in Ukraine have committed crimes and will have to be punished for that. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the two were endangering Russian lives by firing at and shelling military personnel. According to Peskov, Russia cannot guarantee that they will not face the death penalty. He says the nature of the crimes will be investigated. These are the first official comments coming out of Moscow about the two Americans after the U.S. State Department said that it had seen reports of their seizure. Both captives are reportedly U.S. military veterans. Earlier, a Russian-backed court sentenced two Britons to death for fighting as mercenaries alongside the Ukrainian army. The top Russian official says holding nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. is pointless, suggesting that Moscow should wait until Americans come forth and beg for negotiations. The former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, believes that there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmament with the U.S. yet, because it is bad for Russia. Medvedev says that Washington and Moscow don't have any relations now, and therefore everything is, in his own words, a dead zone. As Russia's president, Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010, when then U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years, but fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise, amid critically sour relations over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers. They control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. Belgian police say tens of thousands of people took part in a march through Brussels on Monday, demanding government measures to offset record-high inflation. This is while the European Union comes under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up and the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot, and they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost of living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Barely 2 weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson narrowly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. And yet Johnson has decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the coronavirus pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some two decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
The UK has, in essence, thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on Rwanda Agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and receive asylum procedures. Now, the controversial £120 million deal is coming under heavy criticism in regard to its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to the Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
Iran slams Israel's, quote, outrageous allegations against the country, saying the regime wants to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region. Iran's UN ambassador says that Israel is infamous for its racist policies and hate speech and cannot hide this fact through propaganda. Mehdi Tahta Rawanchi was speaking to anti-Iran allegations by Israel's representative at a UN meeting, which was marking the first international day for countering hate speech. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian envoy warned against the growing trend of Islamophobia, saying that such tendencies lead to violent extremism and threaten the security of all societies. He cited the politicization and the restriction of the hijab, the burning of the Holy Quran, and the desecration of Islamic symbols and holy sites in some countries. Tahta Rawanchi blamed this situation on anti-Muslim media outlets and civic groups promoting Islamophobia in the West. He also lamented the lack of resolve on the part of certain governments to confront hate speech and acts of hate against Muslims. Also, in another address to the UN Security Council, Iran's envoy condemned Israel's continued attacks on Syrian civilians and infrastructure, particularly the recent strike in Damascus International Airport. Iran's UN ambassador described Israeli attacks on Syria as malign and an act of terrorism. Majid Tahta Rawanchi said Israel's raids violate international law and Syria's sovereignty while jeopardizing regional stability and security. Expressing Iran's support for Syria, the envoy said Damascus has a legitimate right to defend itself in line with international law and the UN Charter. The Iranian envoy also called on the UN Security Council to abandon its double standards by unequivocally condemning the repeated Israeli aggressions and holding the regime accountable. Syrian air defenses have succeeded in intercepting the majority of missiles fired by Israeli aircraft, although they still cause material damage and casualties. Damascus says the Israeli attacks are carried out in support of terrorist groups in the Arab country. Last week, Russia summoned Israel's ambassador over recent airstrikes against Damascus International Airport. Yemenis are still suffering from the consequences of the Saudi-led war, despite the UN truce entering its third month. Abdul Latif al-Washali has the story.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti, but much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the 7-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons. People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and the children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Tunisia's president has received the draft of the new constitution that would increase his powers less than a month before a referendum on the document. After receiving the draft on Monday, President Kais Saied said that some chapters needed amendments. Saied has until June 30 to approve or to edit the draft, which has not yet been disclosed to the public. He intends to put the new constitution to a referendum on July 25th. The opposition has said that it will boycott the plebiscite, while thousands of Tunisians protested against the referendum over the weekend. The president has already appointed a new electoral commission, casting doubts on the credibility of any vote. He has also appointed a temporary judicial council and has sacked dozens of judges. Saied seized executive power last year, dissolving parliament and ruling by decree in a move described by his opponents as a coup. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on those clergy and quasi-clergy who are unaware of Islam, but try to portray the capitalist and socialist economic models. In this episode, we are going to touch upon other parts of his testament in which He warns the clergy against being affected by rumors of those who are ill-wishers and enemies of the Islamic system. Stay tuned, please. When Imam Khomeini started his revolution in early 1960s, some of the ulema were opposed to him, even warned him of struggles against the regime of Shah. However, with the spread of the revolution, little by little, more ulema joined him. Nevertheless, a small number of these ulema continued opposing the Imam. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the new system of government, Iran faced myriads of internal and external problems. These included the moves of the remnants of the royal system, efforts of separatists to damage national unity through creation of riots here and there, and most importantly, the plots of external enemies to overthrow the system, or at least to fully render it inefficient. The all-out Iraqi war in 1980s was the climax of these plots. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament to those who kept finding fault with the Islamic system instead of helping it through giving solutions, "I recommend to those who, due to some mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, are strongly opposed to the Islamic Republic itself, and for God's sake, are active to overthrow it, thinking that this republic is worse than or the same as the royal regime, just to ponder honestly in their solitude and fairly compare it with the former rule and regime. Besides, they should pay attention that chaos, mistakes, and opportunism are inevitable in revolutions in the world." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enumerates some problems facing the Islamic Republic system, such as the internal and external conspiracies, armed assaults, infiltration of corrupt elements in various government establishments, etc., and advises the ulema not to be deceived by media hype and rumors. He writes, "You should pay attention and consider the hardships of this republic, including plots, false propaganda, armed attack from outside and inside, inevitable infiltration of some corrupt groups and opponents of Islam in all government centers to make people discontent with Islam and the Islamic rule, being inexperienced of most or many of the authorities, spread of false rumors by those who have been denied or receive little illegitimate benefits, considerable shortage of judges and back-breaking economic problems, shortage of skilled and expert righteous people and scores of other problems, which one will be unaware of them unless being in the scene, in addition to those super-capitalist persons who are proponents of the royal system and through usury, profiteering, immense overcharging, smuggling and hoarding, have pressured the destitute and deprived in the society to the extent of perishing and have been causing corruption in society. I humbly advise the respectable ulema not to be affected by these rumors and strengthen this republic for the sake of God and preservation of Islam." We'll be right back. Imam Khomeini advises those who are hell-bent on toppling the Islamic Republic system that once this system is toppled, the substitute will be a regime that will be the flunky of either the West or the East. He writes in his testament, "The respectable ulema should know that if this Islamic Republic fails, it won't be replaced by an Islamic regime which is intended by Imam Mahdi or one which is obedient to you. Either regime will be take power, which is intended by one of the poles of power, and the deprived of the world, who have enthusiastically turned toward Islam and the Islamic rule, will be disappointed and Islam will be isolated forever. And you will regret your acts when the die is cast, and there is no use in regretting. If you expect everything to change overnight, according to Islam and the laws of Almighty God, it is a mistake. Such a thing has not happened and will not happen throughout the human history. And on the day that, God willing, the absolute reformer, Imam Mahdi, will emerge, you should not think that there will be a miracle and the world will be reformed in one day. Rather, the oppressors will be suppressed and isolated through efforts and self-sacrifices."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The headlines could not be any clearer. Leftists with plans to upend the economy wins the Colombian presidency. Former guerrilla Gustavo Petro pledges to expand the state control of the economy. That in itself is a headline, but the real headline reads how Gustavo Petro has overcome decades of establishment rule in U.S.'s top Latin American ally. How has he done that? And does he plan to ally the country with the U.S. like in the past? Just a couple of questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight, including why Latin American countries are going left overall and perhaps away from U.S. and Western influence. First, these are the guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Co-chair of the Green Party of the United States, Ahmad Altuni, who joins us from Union, New Jersey. Also joining us is an author and journalist, Arnold August, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Arnold August, I'm going to first start with you. We're looking at this win, Gustavo Petro winning the Colombian presidential election. And in general, the description has been given that this will make him the first left-wing leader in the South American nation's history and the first former insurgent. Tell us, first of all, the significance of why this is so important, in your opinion.
Well, it's extremely important. As you said, it's the first time in over 200 years that a left-wing person has become a president, along with his vice president elect. Now, we have to take into account that many years of Uribe dictatorship in Colombia, the very close ties between Colombia on the one hand and the United States on the other hand, to the extent that Colombia has been honored to have a special relationship with NATO. It goes to show how close they were. Of course, last time I looked at a map, Colombia is not even close to being anywhere in the North Atlantic, but it gives you a very good idea of how close the ties have been. So it's really earth-shaking that you have a presidential ticket who is on the left and has a tendency towards taking a relatively independent stance with regards to the United States. And I think that, of course, all of the Latin American leaders were very happy. Of course, they congratulated the Petro Marquez ticket, indicating that this is a new move for Latin America towards the left. This is true, right. But the fact that it's so important and earth-shaking is sort of a double-edged sword. There's also a negative thing that one has to take into account, which I guess I could deal with later.
Okay. Well, I was going to get into this a little bit later, but let's get right into it, Ahmad Al-Tumani, in terms of how we're looking at this move to the left being defined as a move away from Western influence, in particular the U.S. Tell us why that is important. I mean, Latin American countries or other countries around the world, they want to have a close relationship with the U.S. But what has led the countries, in this particular case in Latin America, and of course Colombia, to have distanced themselves from that?
It's years of oppression, years of U.S. imperialism. I mean, when you think back to the days of Efrain Montt in Guatemala, and where we are today, it's kind of self-explanatory why we're headed in this direction. And the U.S. has been pushing back. I mean, I like to say that this what we're seeing here is the second wave of the pink tide. In the early 2000s, we saw this starting, and with the Bush administration, I don't want to say turned a blind eye, but they were a bit incompetent in terms of Latin American politics, what they focused primarily in the Middle East with the Iraq War and all that, and that kind of allowed movements in Venezuela to come up with Chavez and Rafael Correa and Mojica in Uruguay, and then with the Obama administration afterwards, we kind of saw a reverse of that, and almost to an extreme, as we saw with Bolsonaro come in Brazil, kind of completely in the opposite direction. So what we're seeing now is a second wave of that pink tide, where, right now we're seeing leftist governments pop up in Peru with Pedro Castillo, in Chile, in Argentina, Nicaragua with Ortega, obviously, and AMLO in Mexico. Even in Brazil itself, there are predictions that Lula is going to beat Bolsonaro this year. So we're going to see kind of a clean sweep in Latin America. And what makes this election in Colombia so historic is that Colombia was Old Faithful for the United States. Like my colleague over here said, it's been over 200 years, and we've never seen a leftist government in Colombia. They joined NATO as a global partner in 2017, which just shows you that extreme relationship between the U.S. and Colombia, how they could always depend on them for their imperialistic endeavors and ambitions. And so seeing this happen in Colombia right now, this is a special day. And I think all of Latin America is rejoicing. And it's a big deal for the world, too, because, sure. Once you do that clean sweep in Latin America, you've got other parts in the world who are also suffering from imperialism from the West and Europe. So hopefully this is going to be a starting point for more of a global trend heading into the left.
Well, you know, if somebody from the outside is listening to this Arnold August, they're going to say, maybe, what are we talking about here? You know, maybe it's good to review what has happened, economically speaking, from countries that were aligned with the West, that were aligned with the U.S., because looking at just some of the stats, annual economic growth from 2013 through 2019 was just 1.2%. Poverty dropped from 45.6% in 2003 to 27.8% in 2014, but since then it has gone up and hit 32.1% in 2021. Extreme poverty, corruption, and just an economic system that should have benefited from it being somewhat mixed with the Western opportunities, but it didn't pan out. So this is where we are. Is that the main reason why we're seeing the move to the left and away from the Western systems?
For sure. I mean, these statistics that you mentioned and many others indicate why people are revolting, for example, in Colombia with regard to this historic elections. And just by coincidence, I guess, while the elections were going on in Colombia, you have in Ecuador an important mass movement against a pro-U.S. right-wing government in Ecuador. So this is an ongoing thing. But I think that the danger is, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. We're all happy. It's a great victory. And believe it or not, the United States issued a statement yesterday, only several hours after the results of the elections. I'll just read one point. I think it's important. Blinken said the U.S. and Colombia enjoy, first he congratulates the new the winning ticket. Then he said the U.S. and Colombia enjoy deep bonds between our peoples, shared values, and shared interests in democracy, security, inclusive economic prosperity, and human rights. He goes on to say cooperation between the U.S. and Colombia has improved public health, livelihoods, rule of law, and environmental protections of both our countries and throughout the region. I mean, the United States should wake up, because this has not been the case of Colombia. It is this very reason why the majority of Colombians dare to courageously stand up, go against the tide, and vote for this left-wing ticket to oppose these problems that are caused by the U.S. in the first place. But you know, one has to be careful. We cannot, like, we can, you know, for example, what happened in Chile? I mean, we cannot compare Chile to Colombia, and the Petro Marquez ticket, of course,
right,
can be compared to Allende. But what happened there, they actually overthrew that elected government. I'm not saying this is going to happen. But given the importance of Colombia, as we all three of us have mentioned right from the beginning,
right,
one can also expect some action by the United States to try to undo this historic victory.
Okay, let's talk about the challenges in terms of Colombia, in this case in point, Ahmad Altuni. One of the promises that Petro has said is that he wants to ensure that peasants are going to have their rights guaranteed. This is just one example that I picked, against multinational corporations, including Colombian oligarchs. Now, when you talk about multinational corporations, isn't that going to be tough to try to take any stake that they may have in the economy, because many of them have strong ties to the West, especially the U.S.
Yeah, well, you know, in every case around the world, anytime there's a revolution, step one is to prepare for the counter-revolution. I mean, it really is as simple as that. I mean, we're seeing this right now in Venezuela, what's happening, what the Maduro government has been going through for the past 10 years or so has been immense U.S. pressure and sanctions against that country, trying to get the Bolivarian revolution to fail. So what we're going to see in Colombia, when you have what I called Old Faithful earlier, you know, have this historic election, yes, the U.S. is probably going to try to interfere, and these multinational companies are going to try to put an immense amount of pressure on our Department of State to do something about this. And given the violent history in Colombia, I am worried for the life of Petro, but, you know, hopefully Petro is going to be safe, and Marquez as well. But at the end of the day, accomplishing these things is going to be difficult given the struggles that we've seen in the past. But because right now we're seeing these widespread revolutions happen throughout Latin America, you can depend on other allied countries in the region to fulfill these goals that you have. You know, Venezuela is a great example how one of the major struggles that they had was because Colombia was such a great ally of the U.S. that they applied that same amount of pressure on Venezuela and cut off complete diplomatic ties. And so this made things really difficult on Venezuela because they share a border with Colombia. And now that we have Colombia joining the Pink Tide, being able to work with countries like Venezuela, work with countries like Iran, countries that have been oppressed by the U.S. and try to form something together if the U.S. places any kind of pressure or sanctions upon them, I think it's something that can be accomplished. But with that being said, Petro is by no means of the same breed as a Hugo Chavez, as a Fidel Castro. I don't think is going to reach that extreme where we're going to see that kind of response happen. But how successful he can be, that's yet to be seen. It's primarily based on the fact that there is not a majority in the parliament for leftist candidates. I mean, they did a fantastic job in these elections, in the parliamentary elections earlier in March, but they still don't hold a majority. So how much change can actually come right now, that's still yet to be determined.
Indeed. Of course, we're looking at what I'm assuming for this to be correct, where with Petro's victory, Arnold August, all but one of the Latin American major countries would be led by anti-establishment leftists, if you want to call. And the other one is Brazil, which we're looking at all projections pointing towards his win. And Lula da Silva is really the types of approaches that he has towards the whole region is quite phenomenal. I mean, when he talks about the unity that needs to exist, he talks about creating a currency in Latin America called SOR, which is to combat the dependency of the dollar, and basically to have the countries unite in order to cumulatively deal with inflation in the region. And this is in a move away from the U.S. So are all these countries going to be lined up on the same page when it comes to this, do you think?
That's a very important question. In addition to what our colleague just mentioned, that the one of the problems for the Petro Marques ticket is that the majority is still in the hands of the right-wing forces in their parliament. In addition, one has to recognize the very ugly fact that the army is still in place, which is a very formidable force in Colombian politics. So. But on a positive side, even though Petro has been relatively critical of the Maduro government, which is, almost par for the course for these type of leftists, but at the same time, he did pledge to have good relationship with Venezuela and recognize the Maduro government, which is really earth-shaking, because all these years, since Chavez was first elected right up to recently, Colombia has been the main instrument of the United States to try to destabilize Venezuela and overthrow the Maduro government. Now, what Petro was saying is the opposite. He is going to establish good relationship with Venezuela. And the upcoming elections in Brazil are extremely important as well. If Petro Marques could sort of maintain their initiative without too much antagonism against the United States, that will lead to the new government in Brazil, and it will strengthen the overall left movement in the United
Okay, Arnold August, you just froze. Let me come to you then, if I may. Ahmed, looking at a nail in the coffin, so to speak, of the way that the relationship between the U.S. and Latin American countries are, perhaps was so evident than what happened just very recently, and it was the Summit of the Americas. I mean, you're looking at headlines that says how weak the U.S. now is, what's behind American decline, the Summit of the Americas offering a measure of how far the U.S. has fallen, headlines like that. And, of course, you had the ones who either didn't come or sent low-level delegations and basically boycotted what used to be a summit where they clamored up to join. How did it get to that for the U.S. when it comes to these Latin American countries?
Well, you know, you push somebody up against the wall, eventually they're gonna have nowhere to go except fighting back. You know, like I said earlier, we look at what happened back in the 80s or even before that, you know, with your friend Monte in Guatemala, with Pinochet in Chile, the military junta in Argentina. I mean, this is what U.S. policy in Latin America was built on from the get-go. You know, the whole Reagan-Contra affair that took place in Nicaragua. I mean, there are horror stories that take place as far back as the last millennia. And once the Pink Tide started to liberate these folks who had been subject to this type of policy from the U.S. for all these years, there was a blind eye turn. But now we have that second wave of the Pink Tide coming, and it's looking like it's going to be a clean sweep around Latin America. And at that point, that's how you end up seeing situations like the Summit of the Americas, where, you know, it's lost its respectability because you have all these countries right now who see it for the joke that it is, and see Venezuela and Cuba being excluded and saying, well, we want to create our own thing. You know, this is what happens when you have this hyper-capitalistic, hyper-oppressive system thinking that because you have a more powerful military and because you have this grand economy that folks are going to have to depend on, you can be as oppressive as you want to be. No, that's not going to happen. Eventually, folks are going to fight back. And you know, you look at stories like little Cuba, you know, a small, tiny island nation that, you know, had one of the worst embargoes for 50, 60 years, and it's still kicking. It's still surviving. And, you know, I view that as the inspiration for Latin America. Hugo Chavez then comes in 1999, and it's this rebirth again. And now what we're seeing is, you know, virtually every country in Latin America is now looking to the left, understanding that these policies of focusing on enriching the pockets of the West and the United States, hoping it'll trickle down for a select few in your country. Right. You know, the people are going to fight back, and they're going to say, we don't want to be excluded. And that's really who Petro focused on. He focused on the people on the periphery of Colombia, in these departments all the way in the periphery. That's where he won most of his votes in that first round, along with the major cities, obviously, who always tend to point to the left. The one exception being the Department of Antioquia, which is the only one that kind of voted for the establishment. They supported Federico Gutierrez. And, you know, and then the rest of the countries in Colombia, they kind of they had this fear of leftism because of this informational war that's always existed in Colombia that resulted in massive assassinations, including Bernardo Aramillo, the presidential candidate in 1990. 21 other lawmakers and, you know, hundreds of other politicians have been assassinated during that time, which is what made Colombia be the most dangerous place for the left in the entire world. And so we're seeing that with this historic.
All right. Well, you know, it's very interesting how this has occurred for the U.S., Arnold August. And perhaps you can tell us, it just looks like the U.S. has fallen a step behind. I mean, there obviously must have been signs coming from Latin America. We could look at their policy towards Africa even there. They are behind the Chinese, even the Russians. Of course, when it comes to West Asia or the Middle East, as some call it, you know, there also failed policies of the U.S. has almost have them out of that region, like countries, even their parliaments, like in Iraq, voting to have the U.S. out of their country, for example, U.S. forces. And a lot of this has to deal with the foreign policy of the U.S., I'm guessing. Of course, that's my guess. But how is it that the U.S. has fallen behind? And this comes all under how many people are saying it's a power that's on the wane, that's going down, so to speak.
Yeah, it is going down. I think we all saw Joe Biden falling off his bicycle a couple of days ago. I don't want to make fun of that, but it's indicative of something, I believe. I think one has to take into account that while the new Colombian government definitely has roadblocks ahead of itself, but time is on its side, because while in Los Angeles, the United States was excluding Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua from their summit there, a person called President Maduro at the very same time had a very successful Eurasian tour, including in Iran, which culminated in a new 20-year pact between Iran and Venezuela, including on defense and other issues. So you have this whole international development where left-wing governments in Latin America are also extending its principal ties with other countries as far away as Eurasia, and that is playing in the favor of the current Colombian government, who no doubt will have trouble in the next months and years, but they have this to look forward to, a strengthening of alliances, as you say, of countries all over the world, virtually, against U.S. hegemony. And there's no doubt about it, U.S. hegemony is definitely falling down, it's decreasing, its importance in the world scale has been dealt very serious blows.
I'm going to give 30 seconds to you, Ahmed El-Touri. Our guest, Arnold August, talk about this historic visit by Maduro that came to Iran. You know, when you take a look at it, Venezuela having the most oil reserves, Iran coming in at third, aligned with Russia, and, of course, China, we could talk about how they are not only a good buyer of oil, but also they produce their own oil. But we are looking at what has now been deducted to be a bloc, which controls almost 42% of oil reserves of the entire world. Isn't the U.S. concerned that due to their policies, these countries are aligning with each other, and in this case in point, gobbling up 42% or owning 42% of the world oil reserves? Obviously, that's going to spell trouble, especially taking a look at today's landscape.
Well, you know, since you're only giving me 30 seconds, I'll put it this way. I've always liked to say that the Clinton administration was the last administration of competent imperialists, right? Since then, we've had imperialists trying to, you know, just go, oppress, enrich the pockets of the wealthy and, you know, all that. But they haven't done a very good job. They haven't really thought things through. And this is kind of what we're seeing with this Biden administration, which is just kind of behaving the way it always has, thinking the U.S. is going to come out on top. But, you know, as you put it yourself, you see this block forming and the U.S. is kind of looking pretty stupid. Right?
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Ahmed El-Touri from Union, New Jersey, co-chair of the Green Party of the U.S. Arnold August, thank you so much, from Montreal, author and journalist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahway. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Quranic and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions on different issues in Islam And for that, we are trying to invite different scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us answer the questions that we pose in this series of shows. Like recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, a researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the question that we shall pose today. Before starting our discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh Murtada to the show. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure for us to have you here, Sheikh. The question of the day that we want to ask it from you is about the reality of evil eye. We want to see if, does it really exist first, and how can we understand that we have been a victim of an evil eye if it has a reality behind it, and what is the philosophy of it? This is what we want to know everything about, dear Sheikh, and to see what and how Islam looks at this topic.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. So first of all, the first point is that evil eye is not something which is believed only by the religion of Islam. We see the same concept among other religions. For example, it's been mentioned that we have the same concept among the Jewish people, and even those people who do not follow any religion, I'm talking about the polytheists, for example, before the advent of Islam, it's been said that the Arabs in that time, in the so-called ignorance era, they also believed in evil eye. Mm-hmm. And also they believed that evil eye can be coming from animals as well. So the first point is that it's not something that Islam brought it about. No, we have it. And nowadays we have it among different cultures.
So on its reality, there is no doubt. It
does
exist.
I'll come to the reality, but people should not think that this is something which was brought about by Islam and only mm-hmm. Muslims believe in that. No, we have it among the followers of other religions, and also the followers of, I'm talking about the people who do not follow any divine religion as well.
So regardless of that, we want to know that something that different, let's say, people, different followers of different religions have such a belief in. But does it really exist?
Now, answering this question, we need to refer to the Quran and the narrations. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the Noble Book of Quran, two verses are said to be related to the concept of the evil eye. We do not have the concept of Ayn or evil eye mentioned directly in the Noble Book of Quran, but two verses are somehow indirectly related to the concept of evil eye. One of them is in chapter Qalam, verse 51, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَإِنْ يَكَادُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لَيُزْلِقُونَكَ بِأَفْصَارِهِمْ لَمَّا سَمِعُوا الذِّكْرِ And those who disbelieve would almost smite you with their eyes when they hear the reminder, that is the Quran. وَيَقُولُونَ إِنَّهُ لَمَجْنُونَ And they say, most surely, he is mad. This verse is talking about the concept of izlaq, and according to many verses, this concept of izlaq, which here is translated as smiting, be'afsarihim, through the eyes, according to many scholars, it is related to the evil eye. Mm-hmm. And for example, for the occasion of the revelation, it's been mentioned that some of the polytheists of the city of Mecca, they ask a person who was known for his evil eye to do the same for or against the prophet. And then when the man decided to do so, the archangel Jibreel brought the verse, وَإِيَّكَدُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا And this way the Holy Prophet was protected against his evil eye. We know that this is the famous verse for people who want to be protected from the evil eye. They are recommended to recite this verse. But on the other hand, let me also share this point that there are some scholars, some interpreters of the Quran who believe that no, izlaq has nothing to do with evil eye. And they say that izlaq in Arabic literature can also be used to refer to looking with enmity. Mm-hmm. So لَيُزْلِقُونَكَ بَأَفْصَارِهِمْ means that it is as if they are going to devour you.